You're listening to the Locked In Podcast. Here's your host, Algernon Cash.
I'm Algernon Cash, and you're locked in. Thank you for joining me. We just found out actor Michael K. Williams has passed away, best known for his role as Omar Little in the groundbreaking series The Wire on HBO. Williams received a number of career accolades, including 5 Emmy nominations, but most recently earned an Emmy nomination for his work on Lovecraft Country. And for my audience, if you have not seen The Wire, I'd strongly encourage you to do so. It's available on HBO Max. I think there's about 5 seasons. It is great to binge watch. I just want you to know that show, a lot of people know that I grew up very poor, certainly grew up on the east side of town in a very urban environment, surrounded by a lot of drugs and crime. And I think that show just does a great, great way of just sort of artistically explaining that side of our community and our town, and does it through a really interesting lens. So I encourage people, go check out The Wire, and you'll learn a little bit more about Michael K. Williams, who just passed away, died in his apartment in New York City. Students at Mount Tabor High School returned to classes after a shooting that left one young man dead last week. This was the second shooting to happen in North Carolina. We also had a shooting out in, I believe, in New Hanover County out in Wilmington. And so our prayers are with not only the students at Mount Tabor, but our prayers are with every student across the entire school system and their parents. And so we certainly need to be thoughtful about some of the violence that we still continue to see in our schools. And then lastly, 2 programs, one that provides jobless aid to self-employed and gig workers, the other to people who have been unemployed for more than 6 months, expired on Labor Day. Happy Labor Day. As a result, 8.9 million people will lose those weekly benefit payments, and an additional 2.1 million people will lose a $300 a week federal supplemental unemployment payment, which also expired. These recipients will, however, continue to receive state unemployment benefits. However, there is about 25 states across the country that have also ended the state unemployment benefits as well. North Carolina happens to not be one, but predominantly a lot of Republican states across the country. So a lot of people having to get back to work. I understand a lot of people may not be ready to get back to work. Some of it might even be health driven, but those programs have certainly come to an end. And it as we try to move out of this COVID-induced environment that we've been in for now about 18 months. Today on my show, my special guest is John Hood. He is the president of the John William Pope Foundation. Hood also serves on the board of the John Locke Foundation, the state policy think tank he helped found in 1989 and led as its president for more than 2 decades. Since 1986, Hood has written a syndicated column on politics and public policy for North Carolina newspapers. It appears regularly in newspapers in dozens of communities across the state. A frequent radio and television commentator, Hood is the author of 7 nonfiction books on such subjects as business, advertising, public policy, and political history. His 8th book, a historical fantasy novel entitled Mountain Folk, was just published in June of 2021. He's also a good friend of mine. John, thank you for locking in with us today.
Thank you very much for having me, Algernon. I appreciate it.
You know, I learned something about you in the bio. They gave that to me today. I normally just, you know, roughly introduce you as my friend, and I tell people that you used to work at the John Locke Foundation, but we're trying to get a little bit more professional here with the Locked In show now. And it was interesting because when they handed me the bio, I learned something about you. I knew you had been at John Locke Foundation for a very long time. I didn't know you actually helped found the organization.
Well, I did. I was only a couple of years out of college at that point, or actually just a year out of college. I'd been working in Washington at a magazine called The New Republic. And I'd never intended to stay in Washington forever. I wanted to return to North Carolina. I wanted to do some kind of journalism, maybe start a magazine, sort of like the National Review or The New Republic, but aimed at state level politics and policy discussions. Then I hooked up with what was then a freshman member of the North Carolina legislature, Art Pope, who was also an executive with his family's retail business. And he was interested in starting a public policy think tank. We also hooked up with a fellow named Mark Roderman, who had worked in political consulting and communications. And what he was really interested in is sort of bringing to North Carolina the kind of speakers, the kind of regular series of speakers that he was familiar with when he lived in Washington. And so he wanted to do speakers, and Art wanted to do research, and I wanted to do journalism. And so we essentially, I worked for Art for several months, setting up what became the John Locke Foundation. Mark was hired as the first president. I was the vice president. And then a few years later, I took over as president. So it really was something I did in my youth. I had started my syndicated newspaper column when I was still in college, and I continue to write that column to this day. But I wanted to do something more than just write columns in newspapers. I wanted to have a publication that was oriented towards public policy, political discussions in North Carolina. That became what is now Carolina Journal, which is a publication of the John Locke Foundation.
And if you find, if you're a conservative like myself and enjoy reading about conservative public policy, Carolina Journal is a great place to do that. I follow Carolina Journal as well as Amy Cook on Twitter. I encourage my audience to do that. I also had a chance to meet John Hood through the John Locke Foundation. They have a program called EA Morris, which is a leadership program, and they take in applicants or participants every year for that program. And so for my audience, if you're a young professional, you're looking to develop your leadership skills, want to connect with some great people around the state doing great things, EA Morris, you should consider applying there.
You can find out information on that, Algernon, by looking at, I mean, you've already said EA Morris Fellows a couple of times, but that's the web address, eamorrisfellows.org.
Please go check that out. I rave about the impact that that's had in my own community and my professional life. John, you can appreciate this. Bob Numbers, Judge Numbers, let me address him the right way. He was in town with his family recently for a weight game. He reached out. We were able to grab a beer, hung out with him and his kids and his wife. And so that's the kind of facilitation that the EA Morris provides if you're looking to build your networks. You know, I mentioned Mountain Folk. That is your latest nonfiction book. I believe that is your eighth nonfiction
book. That's my latest book, but it's my first fiction book.
Okay.
Actually, Algernon, I should clarify that. My critics would argue that a lot of my previous books were fiction, too. But they weren't intentionally fiction.
Tell us a little bit about the book. You describe it as a historical fantasy novel. What's that about?
Well, you know, I've always loved history, whether it's traditional history books or historical fiction or historical TV shows. I just love history, and I love depicting history. I love that whole idea. I've also long been, since I was a kid, I've long been a fan of fantasy literature, things like The Lord of the Rings, or the Chronicles of Narnia. Harry Potter was something that came along when I was an adult, but I enjoyed it. My kids enjoyed Harry Potter. So I really like fantasy fiction. I really like historical fiction. So my thought was sort of like Reese's peanut butter cups, where you ram together chocolate and peanut butter and create something new. I decided I would push together history and fantasy and see what came of it. And what came of it was a fantasy novel that is set in colonial America. So it starts out with Daniel Boone, who's of course a real person, though he became legendary. Some of the things that he's known to have done, he did. Some of it's sort of exaggerated, but Daniel Boone moved to North Carolina from Pennsylvania with his family in the early 1750s. And so I depict that initial move to the Carolina backcountry, and I depict several other historical characters like Isaac Shelby, for whom the North Carolina town of Shelby is named, who was a settler in what is now East Tennessee and was involved in the American Revolution. I also have a Cherokee woman who's a hero in the story. Her name is Nanyehi, and she's a historical personage who did lots of amazing things. So I take these real life people, and I'm simply trying to tell the story of the American Revolution in a kind of a unique way. Partly by focusing on the frontier. We typically think about the American Revolution as Lexington and Concord and battles with George Washington's army against redcoats. And that's all very important. But a lot of the Revolutionary War was actually a civil war between supporters of the king and supporters of the new republic on the frontier. in places in the Carolinas and Georgia and backcountry Pennsylvania that didn't involve any uniform troops on either side. It's just militia shooting at each other, sometimes cousins or even brothers shooting at each other. And it was also actually a war between American settlers and British allied Indian tribes like the Cherokee. So I'm trying to give that sense of the American Revolution that people don't know as much about, but I'm also trying to explore some other ideas that I found most congenial to fantasy. So in addition to the historical characters that I'm talking about, I also, in my world of mountain folk, there are various kinds of folk, wee folk. You can call them fairies as long as you don't think of Tinkerbell. You know, we're not talking about little sprites with wings who are fluttering around. These are elves and dwarves and their equivalents in Native American folklore and African American folklore. And so I'm pulling some magical and legendary characters from folklore to populate this world, partly because I think it's great fun. I mean, don't you want to see a giant Revolutionary War battle that also involves pixies and a dragon and things like that? Of course you do. But also, what I'm trying to do is really explore what it means to be an American. So I would say, this is partly because when I was young, I was a 4-H'er. So growing up in the 4-H program, I typically think in terms of groups of four. And the way I ended up thinking about my book, Mountain Folk, is that its purposes are really fourfold, and you can call them 4-H's. One of them is history. Another is heroes. The third H is heritage. And the fourth H is human nature. Now, I've already mentioned the historical goal, Algernon, which is just I'm trying to get people who may not know as much about this period in American history to learn more about it. I hope to motivate them to read more nonfiction books about people like Daniel Boone or George Washington or Thomas Jefferson and learn more about what they were really like, learn about the Cherokees and the other Indian tribes and why they allied with the British and how it kind of made some sense but didn't work out very well in the end. So I'm trying to encourage people to learn their history because unfortunately, far too many of us know our history. Some of the surveys are actually pretty scary.
Yeah, a lot of folks don't understand their history. And when I hear historical fantasy, would you say the book targets a younger person, an older person, or a little bit of both?
This is a young adult crossover. In other words, it's appropriate for a teen reader or an adult reader, maybe a precocious preteen or tween. But it's really it's sort of like Lord of the Rings. I mean, a 16, 14, 15-year-old could read Lord of the Rings and appreciate it, and an adult could also. And the way I sometimes express this is that I imagine if the author of the Lord of the Rings had written an epic saga about the American Revolution. That's what I basically have done here. So that second H of heroes is very relevant to what we were just talking about. I think America needs its heroes. Now, that doesn't mean we ought not to learn everything we can about these actual historical personages. I mentioned George Washington. We know why he is considered the father of our country. We also know that he was a slave owner. And so we want to understand all the kinds of the facets of these individuals as we can. We need to know them warts and all. But that's different from just throwing leaders figuratively or even sometimes literally down on the ground. I mean, I'm very troubled by this wave in the last several years of tearing down statues, not just of racists in courthouses, which I actually understand the sentiment there. I don't want to do it illegally, but I can understand moving those statues away. But I mean, even statues like a George Washington or a Christopher Columbus or a Ulysses S. Grant. At some point, when you apply such a test to everybody who's been a hero in America in the past, that if they ever did anything that's objectionable, we're not going to treat them as heroes anymore. I'm afraid we're not going to be left with any heroes. And all cultures need heroes to unify, to give us a common experience, a common epic tale to tell who we are and what the best of us can be. And that's what heroes are about. I do that in the book quite a lot.
Hey, John, real quick, because I got to move on here. Where can you purchase Mountain Folk if someone in my audience wants to check it out?
You can go to Amazon. You can go to Barnes & Noble. You can also go to my website, mountainfolkbook.com, where there are signed copies available for order as well.
And for my audience, stay tuned because on September the 16th, we're actually going to have John Hood here in town in Winston-Salem for a locked-in reception. He's going to be here to sign the book. You have a chance to purchase the book. You have an opportunity to interact with John, learn more about him, learn more about the book, and maybe even some of the other novels that he's written as well. That's going to be on September the 16th. We're actually going to do that at Springhouse Restaurant and Kitchen in their library in downtown Winston-Salem. That should kick off probably right after work. It'll be a pass-through event. You can come by starting around 5 o'clock, pass through, grab a drink, meet John, buy the book, get it signed, all in one sitting on September the 16th. So there'll be more details coming out about that soon. If you're just now joining us, you are locked in. My name is Algernon Cash, and the other voice with me today is John Hood, who is president of the John William Pope Foundation, also, which I found out here recently, one of the founders of the John Locke Foundation and former president of the John Locke Foundation as well. You know, we certainly got to talk politics if we got John Hood on. Lots going on all around, not only our state, but nationally. Certainly, it looked like at least at some point, I think the president felt like he may have been riding high coming into this summer. But this summer has certainly has had a litany of setbacks for the Biden administration, one being COVID and just this resurgence of this COVID Delta variant and the ways that it's obviously upsetting our communities. And you know, obviously, this has derailed the administration's domestic policy agenda. And it's also reignited a lot of debates around mask wearing and vaccine mandates. Right now, we've got more than 40 million cases of COVID recorded right here in the United States of America. Those cases in the United States make up about a fifth of the global cases all around the world, which is about 221 million. And only 47% of Americans are currently fully vaccinated. You know, John, we're starting to hear more and more about municipalities and private sector companies and others mandating the vaccine. I know here in Winston-Salem, if you work at HanesBrand, starting October 1st, if you're not vaccinated, you no longer will have a job at HanesBrand. But we're also starting to see some first responders push back on the idea of these vaccine mandates. Teachers are saying they don't want to take the vaccine. I read an article this past weekend out in Portland. They're going to lose 200 police officers because these police officers don't want to take the vaccine. What are your thoughts about vaccine mandates? I mean, are we on the right road? We got to get vaccinated for all these other things. I mean, so should it be mandated that we all have to be vaccinated and show our little card when we go out somewhere?
Well, I got to distinguish in my mind between whether an institution has the legitimate power to request or to demand a vaccine or proof of a vaccine, and whether it should be done, because I think those are two different things. I'm a believer in freedom in a free society. If HanesBrand wants to require its workers to be vaccinated, I don't think it's any of the government's business to intervene in that story. That's a question between the employer and the employees. I would gently suggest to some of our private sector employees or employers that vaccine mandates that don't have some exceptions are probably not worth doing. They're probably going to create more trouble than they're worth. Almost everybody will comply if you make it a mandate, but have some real exceptions. There are a few people, and I have some in my family, one in my family, who has extreme reactions to vaccines. They have real medical concerns about that. And so I just think as long as we use some common sense and treat each other respectfully, I think that vaccination rates will continue to go up, and they ought to continue to go up. I was fully vaccinated very early because part of my time I spent teaching at Duke University, and all Duke University employees were vaccinated very early. I'm a big fan of the vaccines. I think they have dramatically reduced the lethality of COVID. It's not designed to eliminate the entire disease. You can't do that. We vaccinate against diseases that have been around for hundreds of years. We don't do it to preclude anybody from ever getting the disease. We make it so it is less likely you will have a serious bout or die from the disease. And the vaccines unambiguously reduce the chances of dying dramatically, to where if you are vaccinated and you get COVID anyway, there is a tiny risk that you will suffer something horrible, but it's lower than, for example, the risk that you assume when you get in your car and drive down the highway.
You know, just in the past week, we've had 161,000 new cases per day, new deaths up to 1,385 per day, and hospitalizations now average 103,000 per day. Not quite back at the numbers that we saw during the winter surge, but certainly unpleasant and uncomfortable numbers that I just shared with you. And no state right now, currently in the United States, no state has more than 70% of its population vaccinated, compared to countries like Europe, where the entire country is probably approaching 70% vaccination. I mean, John, I'm starting to hear from small business owners, and they're starting to see a slowdown. And I think part of that is people are self-quarantining, as I explained. They don't want to get back out to restaurants. They're getting fearful again about going to events and concerts. Do you think we may see another round of federal aid to try to support small business? I mean, I'm hearing a lot of small business owners saying they may not make it. I mean, you're hearing those same calls that you heard about 12 months ago.
Yes, and I was all in favor when the state governments, urged by the federal government, shut down large swaths of businesses for a long time. My view was that's actually a taking. That's a regulatory taking, and the government should compensate those affected industries. Now we're in a situation where it's probably not going to be an official government lockdown again, but it's going to be, as you say, people kind of self-quarantining. I still think we need to think about how wisely to compensate businesses for sort of feeling some of the direct costs of this disease. But I also, frankly, think, honestly, Algernon, people are panicking, unfortunately, that they're thinking about last year and this year, and they're not thinking about the very critical difference, which is that if you are vaccinated, then your chances, even if you get COVID, your chances of experiencing a horrible experience or passing away COVID is very, very low. It's not zero, but it's very low. It is not a risk that, in my opinion, a rational person would conclude means you're not going to go out to eat. You're not going to go to a game. Now, if you're unvaccinated, this is a different story, because now you're talking about a strain that's easier to spread and is at least as lethal as the previous strain. And if you're unvaccinated, as we've seen in the death rates, you still face a significant risk. But that's a risk that people are assuming themselves by not being vaccinated. I want us to continue to encourage people to vaccinate. It's important to remember the statistic you mentioned about the percentage of Americans vaccinated. There is a swath of those folks who can't be vaccinated because they're children. So if you exclude the children, I think we're in the 60s or low 70s as far as the number of adults who are vaccinated, but that is still not high enough.
Now, that's a good point you make, and I encourage my audience, please go read and research and understand this at a greater degree. I've heard so many half-truths and misdirection and misguidance and so much out there. You really need to make sure you're following the facts.
I mean, for example, people will say, well, I saw or I heard or I know somebody who was vaccinated, but they still had a horrible bout with COVID-19. Of course. That doesn't prove anything. You know, you want to look at the overall numbers. And if the ratio of people who are unvaccinated to vaccinated having a bad reaction is something like 15 to 1.
Yeah.
So you dramatically reduce your chances of ever being hospitalized or ever facing the risk of death if you get vaccinated.
When I've had some people tell me, well, they don't know how the vaccine works, but my response to you probably don't know how your air fryer works, but it doesn't stop you from using it every single day either. You may want to do that. Recently on my show, I did have Dr. Christopher Ohl, who is a top infectious disease expert at Atrium Wake Forest Baptist Medical here in Winston-Salem. We had him on the show a couple of weeks ago. We also had Dr. Wiggy Saunders from Robin Hood Integrative Medicine. They both presented two different paradigms and two different perspectives of COVID. Those shows are available. You can download them on the podcast at lockedin.cash, or you can go to the Facebook watch page. You'll go to Facebook page and you can listen to both those shows, but they're very interesting. And if you wanting to hear two different perspectives about the same issue from the medical community, I thought Dr. Ohl and Dr. Saunders did a great job of doing that. We're also starting to see a lot of images on our television about the whole Afghanistan exit. And I think many of us, including myself, I believe that it was time for us to come home. We've been there for more than 20 years. We spent probably somewhere around $2.4 trillion. The exit was long overdue. But I also think many of us thought the exit was very messy. And we had a lot of questions about why we saw American troops leaving before we saw American citizens and allies. And I think those questions are going to linger for quite some time. The president now, John, he really wants to shift the conversation back to his domestic policy agenda as we're getting ready to come out of the summer. Do you think the American people will give him a pass on this? Are they going to overlook it?
Well, I don't think they'll give him a pass on it. I think that he's lucky that just on a political calculus that it's not an election year, but the year before an election year. What I fear is that we will have subsequent events. We will have hostages. We will have video of the beheadings and tortures and all sorts of horrible things that are going to happen. I disagree with you, Algernon, about this issue. I freely admit I disagree with most people that I know. But I was not in favor of withdrawing from Afghanistan at all. I thought we should have kept a force in Afghanistan and kept the Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan indefinitely. The message being the Taliban helped hatch a conspiracy to attack America. The Taliban are never going to be allowed to rule any country ever again. That's our job. Now, maybe there's some good things that'll happen in Afghanistan if we stay, maybe not. But the Taliban will never be allowed to be in charge again. That I thought was a pretty clear war aim. And by the time we got to the last several years, the actual cost of the military involvement in Afghanistan was, you know, several thousand troops deployed at any one time, an expensive air base and some other expenses. But the total cost in the, I don't know, $20, $25 billion range, something like that, which is entirely affordable for a country of our size. So I actually thought, given that we face geopolitical threats from Russia and China and a nuclear-armed Pakistan and a potentially nuclear-armed Iran, and Afghanistan just happens to be handily located between all four of those places, I thought it was foolish to give up our base there. That makes me sort of old-fashioned, but I don't think America can wall itself off from what's happening in the rest of the world. I fear that we will have to go back into the Middle East or Central Asia at some point in the future at a higher cost, because we simply would not stick to the plan. But, you know, lots of politicians of both parties and generals and admirals all overpromised and underdelivered, and were never clear about what the war aim was. And it just seems to me that if we had said, I don't know what's going to happen in Afghanistan, and neither do you, but I can tell you what America can keep from happening is the Taliban will never be in charge of this place ever again. That was,
yeah, I mean, that, and I think that's an interesting, you know, perspective you bring. I also think that perhaps the way that we've evacuated or exited the country, certainly the Taliban is more emboldened today than they ever have been in their lives. You know, so they're sitting back and thinking, you know, the Russians came here and spent a decade here. They couldn't get the job done. America spent over two decades here. They couldn't get the job done. So they feel like they're probably the most impressive fighting force in all of human history right now. And so we do need to sit back.
I think utterly preposterous, because they could never defeat the Americans in any significant way ever.
It is. But I do think I agree with you. I think we got to sit back over the next few months and see what really happens. You know, if we wake up and we see images on YouTube of people getting their heads cut off,
this issue sort of like the Iran hostage crisis of 79 can make this issue last for a very long time and certainly affect Biden's support among the public. The public opinion already switched quickly on this, which is not surprising. Public opinion about foreign policy, Algernon, is it's worth paying attention to, because we're a republic and we pay attention to what our public wants, but it is notoriously fickle and shallow. And using a poll to decide what is in the best interest of the country, I think, is not a good idea.
Well, you speak of polls. You know, Biden now joins a really unpopular club. Only Carter, Trump, and Biden had similar low approval ratings at this point in their presidency. You have any early predictions about the midterm elections coming up next year?
I think Republicans will have anywhere from a moderate to a smashing year. Even a moderate gain would give them control of the U.S. House, probably the U.S. Senate. A smashing gain would give them even more control in the states. I don't think we should interpret some of these world-shattering and life-threatening events purely on the basis of what their partisan implications are. But the truth is that Trump was an unpopular president virtually his entire tenure. The public did give him a chance at the very beginning, and he lost that quickly. Biden had a few more months of good graces, and now he's lost that. I'm not sure he can get it back. This is separate from policy, separate from whether we agree with what his decisions are or not. Don't you agree, Algernon? He looks tired. He looks sometimes kind of confused. He does not convey the ability to lead the federal government. And I don't think the public would reelect him if the election were now or next year. I don't think they'll reelect him in 2024. I just don't think they will think he's up to the job, and I suspect they're right.
Some people are questioning whether he'll make it to 2024. Maybe that's some of the images that we see on television. He does look very weak and frail, and oftentimes when he's speaking, he gets confused in mid-sentence.
So I will tell you, if I'm in as good a shape as he when I am 78 or 79 years old, that'll be impressive. But when I'm 78 or 79 years old, I will not anticipate running a large organization. That would not be what I would be doing at that cycle in my life.
And also say this to my audience, because, I've heard some commentary online about, Trump sort of handed Biden this hand grenade. And I mean, you could make that argument. But I also think what is interesting about this debate is that Biden was actually a part of the Obama administration for 8 years. And he was the president's principal advisor on Afghanistan. So he really can't escape this whole issue, this two decade issue that we have. He can't just say, well, he's a new president and he just sort of walked in and was sort of carrying out what the previous president said, because he was a part of it. He's part of the narrative.
He wanted to withdraw from Afghanistan during the Obama administration. And the president at that point, President Obama, was convinced otherwise. I mean, Biden has believed this for a very long time, like it or not, whether you agree with him or not. This is a consistent view of his. He's had an interest in withdrawing within years of the intervention.
I want to pivot before I run completely out of time. I want to bring it back home. Here in North Carolina, the North Carolina General Assembly is 2 months late on finalizing a two-year budget. But it's also worth noting that Governor Cooper has never signed a traditional omnibus spent state budget bill into law since he was sworn into office in 2017. I know Speaker Moore is predicting, Berger is predicting that maybe we'll get something done by the end of September. John, do you think we'll get a budget, and will the governor actually sign it this year?
I think we're looking into October now for a state budget. It's unfortunate. I wish they had been able to move more quickly. I think partly they are trying to sort of negotiate between the two chambers of the legislature and with the Cooper administration at the same time, trying to get a bill signed by the governor. I'm still not sure they will get that. Keep in mind that in North Carolina, the governor can veto or sign or let it go into effect without his signature. I think that's maybe the best the Republicans can hope for, because the governor just doesn't agree with a lot of what the Republicans want to do. But we'll see. I really wish he had signed previous budgets. I think Governor Cooper has a lot of admirable qualities, but he has not played his hand very well during his tenure of having a Republican legislature and a Democratic governor. He could have taken deals with them earlier that would have gotten some things he wanted. And instead, he sort of rolled the dice. He kept basically I'm not going to sign it. I'm not going to sign it, hoping that the voters would deliver him a Democratic legislature. They didn't. They're not going to. And so I think he needs to kind of accede to reality and take what he can get. And I think the Republicans also need to be thinking about it's important to get a bill signed. There's some things they can't do with mini budgets. They need to do with a full budget.
North Carolina is expecting to receive somewhere around $6.5 billion more in taxes and fees through mid-2023 than previously predicted. And that's on top of $5.4 billion in federal funds earmarked for North Carolina in the federal COVID-19 aid package. John, I know you're fiscally conservative. What do our legislators need to be prioritizing with this avalanche of cash they're receiving?
Well, a lot of what they've decided to do is basically three things. They've decided to put lots more money into savings for a rainy day, which I think is appropriate. They're going to spend a lot of money, and this is something the House and Senate have agreed on, and I suspect the governor will too, spend a lot of money, billions and billions of dollars on capital projects, be they university buildings, or infrastructure improvements or all sorts of other things that are happening in the capital side of the budget. That's an appropriate thing to do with money, some of which is just going to be one-time money, and so you don't create a long-term burden by spending the money. And the third thing they tried to do is to discipline themselves on operating spending, because they know that right now the state is flush with cash, but that's probably not going to be what it's like in 2 or 3 years. And so they're growing the budget, the operating budget. That's appropriate in a state that is growing. We have more people to serve in certain kinds of services. So I'm in favor of that, but they're not growing any more than the population and adjustment for inflation would allow. I think that's appropriate. The governor doesn't like that limit, but I think that's the right limit in the long run. So instead of spending more money than the cap, they have significant tax relief. The governor did joke that he could, given all the surplus money, the legislature could fund everything the governor wanted and the tax cuts the legislature wanted, which is true, but the legislature is thinking that's true for now, but we don't want to create, whether it's tax cuts or spending, we don't want to create an expectation that people have that 4 years later we cannot satisfy without sudden budget cuts or tax increases. They're trying to think long-term about this. If only Congress thought this way, but obviously they do not.
You think we'll get Medicaid expansion with all this cash laying around? Or
I doubt it, but I do think there'll be some additional things done in healthcare, but not a straight up Medicaid expansion, which the legislature dislikes because they see it as increasing dependency on government. And the Democrats are upset by that because they sort of feel like this is a free thing to, you know, the federal government's going to pay virtually all the costs for a number of years. And so why aren't you taking the free deal? And the legislature says it's not free. It's still our money. Federal government is still spinning itself into a drunken stupor. And just because the legislature didn't tax the money doesn't mean it isn't money coming out of our pockets in the long run. Obviously it is.
Well, folks, you've been listening to John Hood, president of the John William Pope Foundation. John, thank you for locking in with me today. Once again, just a quick plug. Make sure you go check out his latest novel, Mountain Folk. You can go check that out on Amazon. You can find it online. I'll actually have John here live on September 16th for a book signing. You have an opportunity to meet him in person, ask him questions, buy the book, get it signed, the whole deal. I also want to remind you about a campaign I'm involved in. Over 2 million kids across the country do not have a bed to sleep in. Many of those kids reside right here in Forsyth County. So we've partnered up with A Bed and a Book. And from now until October 16th, we are asking residents to consider sponsoring a kid so that we can give 50 kids a bed to sleep in. So we're trying to get 50 beds for 50 kids. You've got until October 16th to sponsor a bed. The cost of one bed is $250. I do think we've moved about 7 or 8 beds. Thank you if you've already agreed to provide a bed for a kid. And if you have not agreed, we ask that you open up your heart and consider some ways to do so. Make sure you stay locked in with WTOB every Sunday morning. That's where the Locked In Show airs. But you can also subscribe to my podcast. That's available on Apple, Pandora, Spotify. Wherever you like to download your favorite podcast, Locked In is available. Make sure you go check out this past episodes with Dr. Ole and Dr. Saunders that I mentioned to you. Always want to thank my sponsors. I want to encourage people to subscribe if you have not already done so, and continue to follow me online. I'm available Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, YouTube. You can find me and lock in with me in all those places. And until next time, y'all stay locked in.
The executive producer of the Locked In podcast is Algernon Cash for WCG. The associate producer is Tim Beeman for Such and Such Media. The views and opinions in this podcast are solely those of the contributors and are not necessarily those of our distributors or hosting company. This podcast is copyrighted and cannot be reproduced without express written consent of WGC.